Hello, and welcome to Radical Exchange Replayed. This week, we bring you a talk from March 2019, delivered by Vitalik Buterin at the first Radical Exchange conference in Detroit, Michigan. This is a great talk in which Vitalik shares a lot of his own perspective about political economy and also explains the connections between the Radical Exchange movement and the idealistic movements that motivated much of the activity in the blockchain industry under the past half decade. So it's a great way to get to know where Radical Exchange is coming from and to hear some of the thoughts of one of the leading thinkers, both in Radical Exchange and in blockchain. My name is Matt Pruitt. I hope you enjoy this.
Hello, everyone. How are you feeling today? Great. Okay. So I thought I would just get straight into things because I'm terrible at intros. So here we are today, you know, like at the first Radical Exchange conference. And I personally tend to spend a lot of my time going to blockchain and cryptocurrency conferences. And it's definitely a kind of quite a bit of contrast between the two. But at the same time, you know, you can find a lot of similarities, right? So you can find that even though in one of them, you know, people talk about currencies, cryptocurrencies, decentralized exchanges, DAOs, and proof of stake, and various other buzzwords, here, you know, there's a lot of discussion around quadratic voting, harbinger taxes, open borders, charter cities, and like a whole set of different buzzwords. But at the same time, there's a lot of things that are kind of shared in common, right? So there's, in general, a kind of interest in just making the world better, a kind of idealism, just an excitement about new ideas, and a kind of commitment to not just thinking and talking, but also actively doing and experimenting, and really many other commonalities that I wanted to talk about. So first, some history, right? So the kind of blockchain movement as it is today traces its roots from the Bitcoin movement, which originated in 2009, which itself traces its roots from this kind of earlier cypherpunk movements that has this famous declaration of the interdependence of cyberspace was published in the 1990s, but really it's existed in some form since the 1970s, right? And this document is often viewed as a kind of seminal, inspiring document, especially for, I know, of older cypherpunks in the 1990s and 2000s. And this was this sort of ideology that there's something very deeply wrong about kind of politics and corporations and governments as they exist today. And the internet and encryption kind of offer the ability to kind of non-confrontationally and peacefully just opt in to a completely different and what people thought hopefully better model, right? And so one of the kind of properties of this early cypherpunk tradition is this sort of very strong individualistic mindset. So basically this idea that it's, you know, you personally making a decision that I'm going to switch from being kind of part of the old world and we're going to be part of the new world. And the new world is on the internet. Nobody, you know, nobody knows you're a dog and like all of those quotes. And it's something that can just exist on its own and grow on its own and doesn't really even need to interface that much with existing power structures. And ultimately, at some point, should just overturn and topple the existing power structures or, as the manifesto prefers to say, and make their enforcement impossible. So these were some of the beginnings, and these were some of the ideas that inspired people that would be working on, you know, things like encryption for messaging, encryption for storing data, torrent networks, and file sharing, and all of these other things that people were talking about in the 2000s. But then in 2009, kind of a new part of this space came into the picture, right? So this is a pretty seminal event that I think had a lot of impact on people in both the kind of more traditional kind of mainstream political circles and people in these cypherpunk communities. And this is basically the 2007-2008 financial crisis. Right. And what's interesting about the financial crisis is that it got interpreted by these two communities. And in here, by two communities, I don't mean cypherpunk and radical exchange. I actually mean cypherpunk and kind of mainstream. in fairly different ways, right? So a lot of people in the mainstream basically saw this as a kind of indictment of basically neoliberal free market capitalism. And they saw it as a sign that people should instead move to a model where kind of governments control financial systems more and things like that. But a lot of people in this kind of internet libertarian tradition instead viewed it more as a kind of indictment of just the existing kind of mainstream institutional hegemony in general, central banks and commercial banks both included with a kind of equal level of derision. So the now in the mainstream, this of course led to some of the more recent pushes for financial regulation, Dodd-Frank Act, blah blah blah. Here in the cypherpunk community, this was one of these kind one of the kind of big pushes that led to at least a lot of the early interest in Bitcoin. Right, so the Bitcoin white paper was published in October 2008, and Bitcoin the blockchain was first launched on January 3rd, 2009. And inside of the Genesis block, so inside of the first block of the Bitcoin blockchain, you can actually look into the block contents, and there's this kind of memo field in the block that actually contains these words: Chancellor on brink of a second bailout for banks, the Times, 2009, January 3rd. So even kind of Satoshi himself, now you could argue that he was just trying to make a timestamp, but you know, really, there's a lot of ways to make a timestamp, and this was clearly some kind of, this was clearly a statement, right, that this is not just about making a peer-to-peer digital currency, this was really more about something different and something greater. So since then, lots of things happened, right, and I'll explain these pictures. So in 2009, 2010, 2012, the Bitcoin community was mostly just people kind of passively off working in a corner, just kind of doing their own thing, slowly growing Bitcoin over time, getting really, really excited when WordPress started accepting Bitcoin for the first time. Yay! In 2013, Bitcoin and people started experimenting a lot with cryptocurrencies other than Bitcoin, and the Ethereum white paper was published at the beginning of 2014. Now, this was around the time when things kind of stopped being all rosy in many ways. So Bitcoin governance quickly hit one of its first, its first major crisis, which was the Bitcoin block size debate. And what happened here is basically that Bitcoin had a limit on the size of a block in its blockchain. So there's a limit of 1 million bytes, so about 1 megabyte that any block could have, and that was all of the space that you could use to fit transactions. In the first turn of 4 years of Bitcoin's history, nobody really cared about this, and people just thought, oh, no, like it's really big, it's kind of a faraway problem. Because at the time, with the transaction volume that existed at the time, blocks were maybe 30 kilobytes, 50 kilobytes in size. Then blocks went up to 200 kilobytes, 250 kilobytes. Okay, maybe we should start thinking about how we'll think about this. 400 kilobytes, 600 kilobytes. And suddenly and pretty unexpectedly, the debate kind of split into these two camps, right? Where one camp basically said, well, we should just increase the block size. We should just change the rules of the protocol. So instead of the limit being 1 million bytes, the limit goes up to 8 million bytes. The other camp basically said that doing this kind of protocol change, what was called a hard fork, would be too risky, or either too technologically risky or too politically risky, or both. And instead, they adopted this somewhat more complicated technical fix called segregated witness, followed by relying on a more complicated layer two technologies like the Lightning Network. And so we had these different camps, right? So the thing on the the guy on the left is that small blocks with lightning symbols, they're representing all the other transactions happening on the Lightning Network. And the side on the right prefers bigger blocks. This eventually led to a split. and the majority of the Bitcoin community went with a small block side, and the big block side basically forked off the chain, renamed itself Bitcoin Cash, changed its logo to green, changed the logo orientation from clockwise to counterclockwise, and went on its merry way. Now, well, not so merry. The two continued to bitterly argue with each other over internet forums, but this is what happened, right? Now, on the other side, you have, inside of Ethereum, which is this platform that lets you create smart contracts, which are computer programs that control money. Well, eventually, someone created this big computer program called the DAO, which stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organization, which is like this decentralized venture fund where all of the participants who originally put money into it would be able to vote on where the money goes. The DAO got hacked, and when the DAO got hacked, there was something like over $100 million of coins inside of the DAO. And at the time, this was a pretty large percentage of the entire supply of Ether. And so there was this big debate where basically, should we institute an emergency, an exceptional protocol change to basically reverse the effects of the hack? And a lot of people dislike this. They kind of perceived it as being very similar to a bailout, which is the exact thing that they thought that they were fighting against. But a lot of other people thought that this was just a very pragmatic measure to stop like 10% of all of the Ether in existence from just going into the hands of some random hacker. And the hard fork happened, but this ended up leading into a split between two other different cryptocurrencies, the other of which is called Ethereum Classic. So takeaways for cypherpunks, right? So as I kind of mentioned earlier, the cypherpunk tradition started off in this kind of very individualist way. But one of my theses here is that the cypherpunks' attempt to get into the money business kind of forced them to realize some other things along the way, right? And that other thing is that money is this fundamentally social thing in a much deeper way than, say, two-party encrypted communications, right? If I want to talk to you through an encrypted messenger, the only two people that needs to have anything to do with is me and you. No one else needs to know that conversation exists. No one else needs to speak the same protocol or the same language. If I want to send you 10 Bitcoins or 10 Ether, that is a transaction that has to be published and uploaded onto a global ledger and with rules that everyone agrees to. And everyone needs to download and verify that data. And even just those technical factors just structurally mean that cryptocurrencies just cannot avoid dealing with the issues that inevitably arise when people have to be on a common protocol. You have to start thinking about governance, social contracts, what are the kind of common shared expectations of this community, how do changes get made, how do we decide how changes get made, how do we decide how we discuss things, what are the norms of discourse, and all of these other kind of very political things. And even to this day, there's people who would disagree with me, and there's people who say things on Twitter like, oh, but you know, there is no Bitcoin community. There's just a bunch of people that happen to use the same cryptocurrency. And as you can tell, I disagree with this attitude. But you know, I feel like the majority of the blockchain community is definitely kind of realizing more that you know these are issues that we have to deal with. Right now, back to kind of the mainstream world. Right, there's political upheavals that I won't go into further because other people have talked about them already. And within the liberal radical movements, both the upheavals of 2008 and then immediately right after that, these upheavals of 2016 led to some kind of a lot of soul searching and interest and reactions and new ideas among kind of many people, right? And here we have Glenn Weil, who wrote these really wonderful screeds that I encourage you to read on where one explains kind of his differences with one of the kind of more mainstream reactions to these events, which is the kind of 1950s style centrally planned statism. And the second thing that he reacts to is basically people saying that we should just have free market capitalism with kind of slightly more welfare and give people universal basic incomes and so forth. So he basically argues here that, you know, because of things that we've learned, and really because of things that we've known all along, they're like both of these kind of ideas are kind of intellectual dead ends. And if we want to actually achieve sort of the underlying ideals and values behind it, behind why people would want, you know, things like capitalism and things like socialism, we need some new and kind of different approach to achieving them. So common threads between these two communities, right? So decentralization is a big one. On the cryptocurrency and blockchain side, blockchains are just intended to be decentralized. People just use that word all the time. People talk about decentralized autonomous organizations. People complain about mining centralization and see it as something bad. So people talk about decentralization as this sort of major goal in the cryptocurrency and blockchain community all the time. Now, in the radical exchange community, how many people here agree with the neo-reactionary opinion that the solution to the problems of the United States is to go back to being ruled by King George III? Okay. King George IV, maybe? Lee Kuan Yew? Okay. So now, aside from decentralization, there's another kind of value among the communities is just community itself, just like realizing that things like public goods matter, things like the need to maintain kind of healthy public discussion and healthy norms of discussion as a kind of as a global commons, even between people who disagree with each other, as something important. The need to kind of reach between different constituencies and kind of talk and bring people together. Just valuing kind of the opinions of different people in the community, trying to kind of make compromises and make common decisions. I think all of these things are things that people in the radical exchange community value, but also things that, you know, this kind of cypherpunk community has kind of been sort of dragged in, sometimes peacefully, sometimes kicking and screaming, in kind of more into valuing more and more over time, right? And now that said, both communities also value and this word that Glenn really likes, which is polypolitanism, which is the idea that, you know, there is no single kind of single community and kind of single way of categorizing people that defines us. And this is something that, I mean, Glenn has talked about quite a bit explicitly. And even in the blockchain space, for example, like one of the effects I've noticed that it has around the world is that it just the fact that people end up identifying with these kind of cryptocurrency tribes or just going to these international conferences even just gives people an alternative for kind of something to consider as their team to, you know, just their country, for example. And and even aside from that, you know, cryptocurrency is the sort of thing where you don't need to be part of one team. You can be multiple teams, and you can be part of the Ethereum community, but also be part of the OmiseGo community, which is part of the Ethereum community. So it's the kind of blockchain space, I would say, is inherently kind of polypolitan in all of these ways as well. Now, another important kind of value of both communities is mechanism design, right? So I think a lot of people are interested in things like quadratic voting, like liberal radicalism / quadratic finance / CLR, Harberger taxes, I mean, because these ideas are, I mean, they're not just kind of radical, they're not just radical in the way that many other ideas are radical. So they're not, for example, radical in the way that replacing everything with pure private property rights is radical, right? These ideas are kind of radical in a way that has like a lot of really interesting and economic analysis behind it, and even kind of strong economic arguments for why some of these mechanisms actually are the optimal thing for doing what the intends to do, right? So you quadratic liberal radical funding, just if you assume the kind of conditions of the economic model, which realistically aren't really that much more difficult to assume than the conditions behind the kind of proofs for things like why competitive markets are optimal, then like it is just clearly the way to finance public goods. And so the fact that there is, that these are also just new social technologies with this kind of mathematical backing behind them as well is, I think, one of the things that interests a lot of people. Now, in the blockchain space, on the other hand, like mechanism design is the name of the game. If you even just poke into any of the communities developing proof-of-stake consensus algorithms or sharded blockchain algorithms or plasma chains, state channels, like any one of these new buzzword technologies, all of them have a huge amount of just economic incentives and mechanism design at their very core. So these four things are things that are both in the radical exchange community and in many blockchain communities are very strong, right? So contributions to all of this from the radical exchange community: Harberger taxes, liberal radical matching, quadratic voting, and a lot of just different ideas in terms of mechanism design. Now, what kind of interesting kind of things does the blockchain community bring to the table that the radical exchange community might find useful? Now, first of all, the blockchain community has been kind of incentivizing and leading to a lot of interesting work in areas like, for example, identity. So on the left, you have this the HTC blockchain phone, and it has this feature where if you lose your phone or lose your private key or anything like that, then before that happens, you have the opportunity to specify up to five trusted contacts. And if you lose your key, then any three of those five contacts can basically work together to help you recover your key. And this is all done in a kind of decentralized cryptographic way using secret sharing. So you could even argue that this M of N social key recovery thing is a kind of special purpose identity system, right? And it's a special purpose decentralized identity system. It basically tells the, in some ways it serves the function of telling the blockchain that, hey, you know, if this person actually is them, using these kind of three of five trusted keys as evidence of that. There's zero knowledge proofs. So the crypto kind of space more broadly, and there's not just blockchains, there's also these sort of general purpose zero knowledge proofs to let you prove that you did certain things and that you have data that conforms to certain rules without actually completely revealing what that data is. And this is a technology that's extremely useful in blockchains, but it's also extremely useful in many other kinds of mechanism design that demand privacy. And a lot of the mechanisms that Radical Exchange is working on actually do demand privacy. Also contributions from the blockchain community, just the blockchain itself as a base layer for many kinds of mechanisms, and also a lot of just interesting and weird and really out there work on mechanism design for different purposes. This thing at the bottom is a Moloch DAO, which is another attempt at making a DAO, which is named after Moloch, the rationalist god of coordination failure, which is named after the Canaanite god of child sacrifice. So now, one area of collaboration, security. Security is a real issue, right? So in the case of cryptocurrencies and blockchains, people losing their keys is something that happens and leads to terrible consequences. Better identity systems can help solve this. Now, if we start looking at voting systems, including regular voting, including quadratic voting, including CLR, unfortunately, including everything, one of the big problems with them is basically just fake accounts, right? And it's fake accounts are actually quite easy to get, and if you design systems naively, then you'll just create systems that are overwhelmed by random, you know, 14-year-old teenagers in Albania that just have 50,000 accounts and just pretends to be a community that wants some public good funded when actually it's just buying themselves a Lamborghini. So This is an interesting chart on differences between cryptography and game theory. So in cryptography and game theory are both kind of ways of achieving, in many cases, the goals of coordinating people. And cryptography and game theory have kind of some different kind of parts to them, some different features, some different disadvantages. Game theory often has this weakness that it assumes that participants are not colluding with each other. And that's something that cryptography is actually pretty well suited to dealing with, right? Now, point of contention, identity. Identity is this one area where the still kind of very individualistic and kind of more cypherpunky side of the blockchain space just wants to stay very far away from it. Like, identity is bad. Identity is oppression. Identity means human beings are reduced to numbers. Now, Glenn, on the other hand, has this wonderful tweet, which is he's critical of Ethereum because it formalizes property, but not people, and this is bad. And it's definitely true that blockchains are not sufficient for a lot of the problems Glenn wants to solve, because if you formalize property and not people, then how do you distinguish between 10,000 people that all want some collective funding towards some public good versus 10,000 sock puppets of a teenager in Albania that wants Lamborghinis? The two are literally mathematically indistinguishable unless you have an identity system. So navigating this divergence of views and hopefully coming up with identity systems that serve the goals of both movements, but still avoiding the kind of worst risks of them, is something that I think we can collaborate a lot on. So to summarize, right, these are two kind of very interesting and in many ways different, but also in many ways similar movements and communities. And both bring their own kind of very interesting and unique perspectives to the table, right? So blockchains and people in blockchain communities think a lot about security, think a lot about adversarial models, think a lot about how do I deal with 14-year-old teenagers in Albania that'll want to break the thing. And radical exchange community focuses a lot, especially more on these kind of public good issues. And both have these interesting commonalities, like seeing things like money and other institutions as being social constructs and social technology that we can and should iterate and improve on, and just generally valuing, you know, building things, deploying, and experimenting. So, thank you.
I'd like to thank Vitalik for that great talk and for everything he's done to help build the Radical Exchange community. I'd also like to thank our producers, Jen Marone and Leon Erickson, for Radical Exchange Replayed. Thank you to everyone for listening, and have a great weekend.